Hey everyone, welcome to our weekly edition of the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. This is Scott Poley here with Tom Costura.
Hello everybody.
And this weekly segment features the top stories that threat hunters need to be thinking about, as well as our thoughts on the subject and hunting strategies. So with that, let's dive into the top threat hunting headlines for the week of March 3rd, 2025. What do you got for us, Tom?
All right, kicking it off this week, I got an article from Truffle Security. It's titled, Research Finds 12,000 Live API Keys and Passwords in DeepSeek's Training Data. So as a follow-up to a research effort that Truffle Security previously did regarding large language models, or LLMs, continuously exposing secret data, they discovered in a publicly available data set from and called Common Crawl, which is used by DeepSeek. And there were some very interesting finds. So I'm going to hit some bullets here that I think are kind of the highlights of them. So there were 11,908 live secrets using an internal tool that Truffle Security leverages called Truffle Hog. They use this tool to find those secrets against 400 terabytes of web data. So of note, these are classified as live secrets as they authenticate successfully. So they tested these and verified them to some degree. 2.76 million web pages contain live secrets in this research. Of these secrets, 63% were repeated across multiple web pages. And in one case, there was a single walk score API key that appeared 57,029 times across 1,871 subdomains. So Truffle goes into some detail of how they scanned and searched this large data set, where they ended up building a distributed job queue with 20 high performance servers. And they would download basically 4 gig Common Crawl files one at a time, decompress and split the files, and then leverage their Truffle Hog tool to extract that content store and put the results in a database. And then they would go ahead and repeat that process. Roughly 90,000 times. They mentioned that in this research, they only determined a secret to be live if they were able to confirm with the auth checks for validity. They also mentioned, though, that a large number of strings they found, they did kind of tag as resembling secrets, but had not been verified yet, at least at the time of reporting. So it's worth noting, as they did in this write-up, that this isn't an indicator of a problem, per se, for the Common Crawl data side, but more so that the individual web data, like developer side, is kind of really pointed out. So i.e. like the folks really need to kind of start considering, you know, or think about more, especially since this data is being pumped into these large language models, their development code and the processes to kind of include checks for these kinds of things wherever possible. They did talk through some other interesting points as well. There were 219 different secret types found. So one, the note was AWS keys found in the front end code. So one example was a AWS root key that was used for S3 authentication. They identified a single web page contained 17 unique live Slack webhooks. MailChimp API keys were the most frequently found in this research study. Roughly 1,500 of them were hard coded in front end HTML JavaScript. This could be leveraged for like enhancing phishing campaigns or enrich or build out better impersonation. The first thing it kind of harkened my thought back to was the thing we talked about last week, that Darkula tool. Like you could leverage these kinds of things to encourage that impersonation or make it more seamless. Some of the development firms would use the same API keys across multiple clients, which made it pretty easy for them to almost trivial to identify that the customers of this firm and reveal full client list. But overall, Scott, I found this interesting to talk about. We discussed some of these items around AI and the different security concerns the AI models face pretty regularly nowadays. And I thought that the Truffle Security provided some pretty good insight to how some of these things can happen and how ownership from the developer side of things, from the basic website creation, as one example, we can improve upon or at least point out that it's necessary to consider these things when developing stuff. But curious what you thought of this one, man.
Yeah, I mean, one thing, I mean, you mentioned DeepSeek, but they also mentioned there are other popular LLMs that use the same data set. So I think this is always going to be a concern because data is becoming more of a currency and we seem to be storing more data, whether or not that we see the value innate in it in general. So if things are being exposed in data, you can't just be like, well, 5 years down the road, we're safe. And especially this is why I think policies for how you manage keys and credentials and secrets and things. That's why rotations are important. Like, I don't remember, that was the 2024 Common Crawl. So it's fairly recent data. So you hope that maybe there's some legitimate things there, but the risk exposure as time goes by becomes a lot less because some of these things rotate. But for instance, when you mentioned like AWS Rookie being there, that's not planned on being rotated anytime soon. Like, if people aren't making purpose built key type structures and having approaches to storing things, it's always gonna be a problem. I think that's why always people say like, oh, passwords need to go. It's, I mean, like, I have a hard time with that. Like, how we authorize and how we do things needs to change. I can't just fall into the whole passwords needs to go mantra that people kind of put out there, because I think some of the other alternate solutions have other weaknesses that are just as bad, I guess, in some capacity. That's just my two cents. The other thing I found that was very interesting was how the search algorithm actually works in their truffle hog. So they had a link that took you to like under the hood of the algorithmic power behind truffle hog that talked about the Aho Korsik algorithm. I'm not going to go into it here, but if you're really interested to how some of like search things work, and some methodologies on like object-based kind of programming workflow, it's really cool. I would check it out. I really, the last thing, and this is something that I bring up a lot. So this is a prime example of this. I always, me and actually Lee, when we were SOC analysts in the very early days of our security career together, we were kind of just like at a midnight shift talking through what is it that is really causing like all these security problems. Like, if we could do anything to fix the security problems, what would be the most impactful? And then we kind of drilled it down to the three weaknesses of security. And most commonly people will teach you the complexity is kind of an issue with security because it's hard to secure something you don't understand. Right. So sometimes we have in the past built things so complex to do some sort of job that doesn't necessarily have to be built that way. Like, if we rebuilt it, it would probably be built better. But at the time we didn't know how to do it because maybe it was our first take. But the other two things that always seem to get everyone in trouble is convenience and complacency, right? Two really hard like human behaviors to control. But when you think about people putting passwords and keys and things in the wrong place, they're not doing it because they don't really care, right? It's just easy. So, you know, it's very convenient if you need to have a web page call out to something else instead of trying to like build a key, make the request for the key, get it provisioned for you, wait the week for the team to review and approve whatever that process is. And then you get it and then you can move forward and make something work or to get work done. Like, you kind of putting that work on a back burner potentially or whatever that looks like. Much easier just to have that key that you maybe has access to everything and you put it in a place that's easy to use. And then if that becomes how you work and it worked the first time, you're going to repeat that same thing over and over again. And that becomes almost a complacency component. So I think this just highlights kind of what Lee and I, you know, theorized and talked about as young SOC analysts back in the day, is like, if we could solve those three problems, these types of problems that came up in this, I think would kind of naturally go away. But those are, you know, the human behavior side. And it's really hard to solve, especially where humans meet technology, everyone's not equipped with the same skills and capabilities. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think it speaks, you know, volumes to aim to that target, even with this. You know, when you think about, I kicked around while I was reading this article a bit of like, where does the responsibility of the data being exposed fall? And like, my first thought was obviously, you know, the developers put it there, they messed up, right? They left that out there in the wild. But on the second side of it, though, you think about it, is these groups that are creating these data sets or scraping the web for these data sets and building them, should they take some part of the responsibility too? Not in a way that it's like you want to think about responsibility as who would you blame, but more so like, are we on the same side, right? Because I can see how a data leak in any form in this representation could be bad for all parties involved, right? Like, it's bad press for the company that has the data set. It's bad press for the people who made the mistake and exposed their data all around, right? So thinking of that as like one example, the idea to get to kind of like what you were talking about with you and these ideas for fixing some of that stuff comes on the collaboration, man. Like we get so isolated, I think. And I think that's where security becomes its own problem sometimes, because it's so isolated from these other groups. Whereas if it's possible to have more of a fluid conversation or teamwork mentality with things, we're better together, right? So as much as the human flaw will always get us in trouble, the teamwork will help us get it out of that hole too, right?
Yeah, the it's interesting you brought up the who's accountable for the data being collected. If there's hurtful things in the data, you know, like once something's publicly exposed on the internet and it's potentially crawled itself or cloned or downloaded, even if you want to be a responsible data owner, you've lost the control immediately, right? Like then does it even matter at that point if you leave it up or not? I mean, like, I know there's like, well, you're not being responsible, but it's like just the problem with data in general. And I think it's too hard to hold people accountable for the data they don't know they have versus the people who should be following better practices that are well understood. So I would still go with the ownership on, you know, who's making the mistake versus who's just trying to do research or be innovative or whatever else is going on. Now, granted, if it was like an exfil and a breach, that's a completely different scenario, right? But if they're publicly exposing things, technically they're public. So.
Right. Right. Well, what do you got next for us, Scott?
Yeah, so I was digging this interesting one that I saw. So Trend put out some research, and in their blog or research, it was called "The Black Basta and Cactus Ransomware Groups Add BackConnect Malware to Their Arsenal." So it was an interesting attack that basically typical flow, there's some social engineering. Ironically, they're using Teams. Haven't seen that in a while, but it still happens. If organizations don't have teams set up to where they don't receive external communications directly, obviously people can use that to phish them, and they're acting like IT help through that process. And then they had an executable that they called OneDrive Standalone Updater .exe. I didn't really look to see if that was a normal executable or if that just kind of looks legit, you know. But it's responsible for updating OneDrive. Well, I guess it is, because they used it for abusing a sideloading. So it's actually vulnerable to sideloading. So they actually maliciously loaded a DLL, which was the BackConnect malware, which was their C2 connection. So through this, what was really interesting, obviously when it comes to attack targets, they targeted multiple verticals, right, and multiple countries. So it really came down to what's the monetary gain if they actually compromise you and, you know, so forth, because it's ransomware. But still some standard themes between the two. You got Black Basta and Cactus, right? I think I mentioned. Yeah. And they use similar techniques through Teams, IT support, help desk. So I think it's interesting, even from the initial standpoint, the two teams are using the same approach, right? From a social engineering standpoint, because I've always talked about how similar these ransomware groups are and how they share techniques. Even to that level, it's always interesting when it gets to that level. They also both use the Quick Assist remote access software. So it's kind of like all the other types of remote management tools that have been seen in the past, you know, off the shelf, not necessarily malicious, but will give someone access. They downloaded, and this is the part where it gets really interesting to me, because I haven't seen these couple behaviors, but it was consistent across these two groups in this campaign, which also is weird, right? When you see, okay, they're using two different ransomwares with the same approach. Like, who is communicating with who to do this approach? Because I find this very unique. They downloaded two, I'll call them payloads, but two files from AWS once they had access, and they were BPX files, .bpx. I don't think the type even really matters or the extension, but both campaigns did the same thing. And then they use the type command. So type, and then they put that one file, the first BPX, the second BPX, and then they did export it to basically pack.zip is what they used. And what type, the command type did was it merged all the contents from the first file with the second file, which actually together made a valid zip. So they broke up their compressed file into two parts. We're able to recombine it by using type, which was a zip file. And then they used tar to extract the contents of that zip file, which was a cab file, which is kind of like a, single file store. It's not, I don't know if it really does compressions in CAB, but Windows uses it. So then in Windows, there's a specific thing that break out CAB files called expand. So they expanded that CAB file, which had the DLLs and the OneDrive standalone updater that they use for the kind of the backdoor call. So that was a really interesting path of executions with, you know, the type, tar, and expand, right, is all part of that, which I thought was incredibly weird behavior and always is being done through command prompt, command terminal. Then the other thing that happened, and this is the only thing that differed greatly between the two. I mean, there's one where they saw some activity of WinSCP on one campaign and not on the other for some lateral file movement type stuff. Which, who knows, that just comes down to after they get to the point where they're inside, they find that is an easy way to just move things, or is that usually just tied to that's how they do things every time. But they made a registry edit, and the registry edit tied to what are the C2 IPs associated. And in the first registry edit, they still stored it in the same place. So obviously, it, probably because it's the same back door. But in the first one, it looked like it was the raw IP. And then they'd have a capital A and then the port. Basically saying, hey, go to this IP on this port, this IP on this port. It was like a list that was broken up with semicolons. The second one was similar, but instead of doing a dot for the IP address, it was just a capital B. So I thought that was interesting. I always find like looking at those details fascinating, because is that an update to the back door? Was it a different configuration of the back door? Was that a decision by a person that was like, hey, we need to make this not look like IPs are easy to be detected, or that kind of thing? So that I also kind of found fascinating. If I were looking for something like that, I would be looking for registry edits that actually had the value of, you know, A443 at the end of it at this point, because it might be similar to this, especially if you find it more than once. Like if you're able to say, I found multiple instances of that within the single value, different way, different tools might give you capabilities there. But that attack chain, especially the type, tar, and expand, those were the most telling to me that I thought was really fascinating, because I don't think I recall reading a report that did all of that exactly that way. I've seen where CABs have been moved and expanded and come out of zips and stuff like that. But the whole combining something with type was really unique to me. And then the last call out thing that I thought was interesting, you know, because of the Black Basta release of their chats and everything like that, I always kind of laugh at myself, because I do think it's good for security solutions to pat themselves on the back. But in the chat, which, by the way, is an old chat, right? Like I don't forget, was it last year when the chat was actually occurring? That's where the data is from. So that's not necessarily current. But back then they said, someone complained the trend micro is used in too many places. We need to bypass it. And then some guy responded and was like, we can't bypass trend. But then they also said they had some luck using brute, which is probably brute retail. It's just interesting when companies, you know, they make that claim, but it's like, let's not be misleading. Like if this was like today, I would make that claim, but because the data is old, it'd be cool to say, hey, we were doing something right and we continue to do something good today. But either way, it's just something interesting that they put in there that I was just going to call out a little bit. So what was your take or thoughts?
A couple of things, you know, off the top, it was one of the things that took away from this, a little bit of a side kind of poke. I don't know how you feel. So I don't want to assume this is just something in our field that people think, but I always find it interesting, especially over the last handful of years where there's been this kind of public acknowledgement of takedowns against X, Y, or Z actors. Right. So they talk about Quackbot in this one. Right. And I think that was a pretty loud, from a you know, media or information being let out as far as like the takedown of that. And then you find, like, you know, you fast forward through time, I always kind of laugh because it's like, it's interesting to see that there's things happening, but you see a lot of people talk about it, like, oh yeah, they took this group down and took these actors down, and then it's like, you know, that's it. And it's like, when you see this point where they're like reusing code from them, or there's remnants of that code and like they had previously worked on them, it's like, yeah, okay, you took this group down, but in this realm, this tooling and this stuff's all out there. So by just because you took the group down doesn't mean it's not going to be reused code, right? So what I'm kind of getting at is there's just this idea that's always bugged me personally. And this, there was a big bullet point in this article that pulled that thought out for me, is it's like, you might take down some of the people that were driving the car, but the car's still out there somewhere, right? You didn't seal off the car. You get what I'm saying? Yeah. We always find that interesting. I don't think we talk about that enough, you know?
Yeah, I mean, takedowns don't typically impress me. The only thing I like about takedowns is it should, because takedowns, it's not an easy task, because there's a lot of pieces and a lot of approvals and a lot of players that have to be on board. Like whoever's hosting the space has to be, yeah, we're going to shut these things down. The thorough investigation to make sure they hit all the things they need to hit to be impactful, all that kind of stuff. And I feel like the more takedowns that occur, they're getting better at it, or that's becoming more normal. So I think that part's just good, because it becomes more effective means to just like, hey, if this pops up, we can handle it right away, versus like, yeah, it dwells for years, then we just have to figure it out. But you're right. Like it really comes down to, and that's why I like hunting for behaviors, because if you have, you know, X number of tools that even after takedown, they're shared, other people take them, they modify them a little bit or whatever it is to maybe get around certain security controls. But if the behavior in the core tool doesn't change, that's still an effective way to say, hey, just because the tool's in a different set of hands and they can bypass how they can get it to land and not be detected, but when it runs, it still does the same types of things that we can look for. Like, come on. Like, hopefully we're at that point where that's effective in itself, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like a lot of it's maybe a pet peeve for me. Like, you know, it's just the idea of like, I wish we communicated or talked about this more, because I think it gets lumped into the same thing all the time. Like, oh, here's just another example of stuff leveraged by actors, even though it was quote unquote taken down. But that's not to thwart the idea of going after criminals, right? We should be taking people away from being able to harm others and all that. A couple other things out of this, I thought the Teams thing was interesting. I thought the pairing, so I don't know how often you've experienced this before in some of the things you've dealt with, Scott, but the email flooding's always been interesting to me, not because it's complex or anything, just because it's like a, you know, it's a sleight of hand kind of thing always, right? It's like, I haven't seen the sleight of hand kind of played this way. So it was interesting to me to see that they queued up an email flood followed by somebody posing as a tech support person in Teams saying, hey, yeah, you're having problems XYZ, where the person's clearly seeing that they're having a problem. And it's just, it's like you're using that human psyche against themselves in just another creative way. It's like, hey, we see you have a problem, let us help you. And then you're encouraged to follow through this whole social engineering scheme. And I thought that was impressive. I know it's really subtle, but I haven't seen that before, you know?
Yeah, they're not like, it becomes more targeted, right? Versus just I wonder if someone will click, you know? Yeah. No, it's always interesting how the humans attack through technology. And I'm glad you picked up on that, because I didn't call it out earlier. No, but yeah.
And we're seeing, you know, a lot of the different things are coming out, you know, going around now. There's like multiple different tags for them, but we're seeing now where people are getting social engineered to where they're just copy and pasting code, which for us makes us scratch our head. We're like, oh my goodness, it's like, it's harder than clicking a link. And then on the other side, you see this focused effort to play with the human psyche, right? And it's just, I don't know, you're kind of seeing a trend of how the threat actors are thinking about trying to encourage people to fall into that human behavior, you know?
So I think what's interesting is how social engineering attacks on the person will change as generations start to change, because I would say I still fall in the generation where technology is being built up around me. So I have a better understanding of what works underneath it versus just what's on the surface and how I interact with it. So then when it comes to like having that security mindset or approach to technology, it's kind of like, well, hold on, I don't want to just do anything. I can potentially break something. I'm like concerned about breaking things or doing whatever. And there's a generation now coming up that isn't really concerned about breaking things. They just expect everything to work and they're comfortable with technology. So if someone tells them to copy and paste something to run, they're like, oh yeah, that's easy. I know how to do most of that. Let's just see what happens, you know? So I'm kind of curious how those up and coming generations will be impacted and how they'll be targeted. Obviously technology will completely change a lot between now and then. But the human aspect is going to be very different, because are people going to be more like aware on security or more blinded because they're more comfortable with technology. I don't know.
Yeah, it is. It is an interesting dynamic. Yeah. The other thing too, I was curious about, and I didn't dive overwhelmingly deep, but the part where they actually leveraged those two .bpx files, right? So they pulled those two down and then they would type them into each other. I have to imagine that was a way to try to avoid detection, right?
Oh, absolutely.
It doesn't specifically call that out, but I was trying to think of why. I mean, I assume, but you know, is there some other methodology that would be there? Yeah, there's a lot of layers there, right?
And what I think is interesting there is they didn't need to leverage encryption anymore.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Something to keep an eye on. I got that one noted. I want to see if we see something like that pop up in the coming weeks and months. But
yeah. All right. So what do you got for us next?
All right. My second item for this week is actually coming out of our own house. So it's from Intel 471's malware intelligence team. It's titled Android Trojan TG Toxic Updates Its Capabilities. So quick overview. First identified in July of 2022. TG Toxic is an Android banking trojan targeting user credentials, cryptocurrency wallets, and trying to steal funds from banking apps. Initially targeted users in Southeast Asia, though phishing sites and deceptive apps mimicking legitimate services are also in play. As of October 2024, a new variant dubbed Toxic Panda emerged, indicating ongoing development and potential expansion of targets to European and Latin American banks. So some of the technical enhancements that were on spotlight here, one of the kind of key notes that I was hitting from this article is different things that they're doing for like anti-emulation techniques. So like to detect what kind of environments they're on. So the latest TG Toxic samples employed what looked like advanced methods to detect and evade emulators, really like limiting automated analysis. Mm-hmm. So they have Android system feature checks, which evaluate the device for like, does it have Bluetooth sensors, telephony services, typical things like that that just aren't in emulators. Hardware fingerprinting. This one I thought was interesting. So it'll assess the CPU architecture to identify specific processors commonly used by emulators, like looking for AMD or Intel or things like that. Also the system property analysis. So it would examine device properties like the brand, model, manufacturer, fingerprint values to look for inconsistencies. Again, testing against these things. They're not necessarily net new, but it was interesting to see all of this kind of folded into one. So there's an assertive effort to make sure, hey, we are on the right device and then we're going to do a thing. The distribution methods for TG Toxic, they utilize droppers like Tiramisu dropper to facilitate the installation of the payload. And then it distributes malware through phishing sites, deceptive applications, compromised social media accounts, third-party platforms, often under the guise of like dating, messaging, or financial apps. Implications for the users and security professionals in regard to these kinds of threats. So this is kind of where the conversation sort of starts here, Scott, and I'm sure you have some opinions on this, but it kind of highlights the evolving sophistication of like mobile malware,
right?
And the importance of like robust security measures, which we can talk about. But it emphasizes the need to for continuous monitoring and analysis to detect this. And this is kind of where my head started going. So like, I think from this, Scott, like with the ever-growing threat landscape on the mobile side, that maybe a conversation around putting more focus there is needed. I know there are things orgs can do, because I've had conversations with this and experience from my side in the past, where when you start thinking or talking about mobile, it tends to get shot down over a few buzzwords, right? And there are things orgs can do to help minimize these threats, right? There's mobile EDRs that are getting better and better. App control, and then a lot of the apps on mobiles tend to be containerized, right? But you know, there are still ways in, and I've always felt that, and I think a lot of people don't really look at their mobile devices as endpoints sometimes, right? And I feel like maybe we should be looking at them as more endpoints, and I'm talking like cell phone on the mobile device side, right? Not like a toughbook or mobile work machine. And you know, I just wonder how many organizations have considered gathering data from their company-owned devices. So, you know, like maybe logging to a SIM or amplifying the use of a mobile EDR, or even network logging or some level of hunting against the activity from these devices, or you know, what have you. So, you know, should this be leveled up on a priority level for organizations, or I don't know, with remote work kind of being so prominent? It seems more mobile devices are in the net of potential targets, and we see it constantly, but we don't necessarily talk enough about it. And I know it's I don't know. To me, in my opinion, Scott, we should be talking about this a little bit more and thinking about like effective ways to help or at least bring the conversation to light. But what do you think?
So 100% agree. Like my biggest problem with cell phone stuff is it's literally the largest attack surface. Because one, everyone has a cell phone. And what's crazy is I know kids that get cell phones when they're in kindergarten or first grade, right? Their parents get them. And some don't get them anything, especially locked down or anything. And the kids don't even have computers. So as far as like the largest attack surface in general, there's that. But the other thing is how many people turn off their cell phones? Like they're also like literally always on and always connected. And the only time they typically reboot is they either die because someone doesn't charge them or it gets an update. So, you know, I think it's crazy that there isn't that much visibility, but the privacy concerns alone is like a nightmare. But I think there just needs to be better education for one, because most people, they usually impact themselves either, you know, if they're not updating their devices and they can get hit with like, you know, mass spread, kind of like SMS exploits or something like that, that can make things land, or, you know, typically jailbreaking to try to get free stuff, gets a lot of people in trouble in that space. But the phone itself should be able to recognize, not necessarily prevent it. Some aspects, obviously, if it's a company controlled phone, absolutely. But, it, you know, that's what always worries me about, like, bring your own device. I'm less concerned about the bring your own device when it comes to a computer, because there might be some things you could do there to secure it than necessarily a phone with bring your own device. I'm sure there's a lot of counter arguments to what I just said, too. But yeah, like not being able to, if people can access company apps and company data through their cell phone, and depending on what's actually being shared that could be sensitive, like you really have to understand all that. And if there's no like credentials really being shared and there's not sensitive data, then yeah, who cares, right? It just depends on what your business is. So I think that the risk assessment is like incredibly important when it comes to managing these devices in a company setting on making the right decisions. There's a company, and I can't remember the exact name. I interviewed the guy who ran the SOC, but it was Black something, I think. And I did an interview, and their model was basically how do we secure the executive board members? Like that's what they were focused on, to the point where they had their own app that they put on their, and so they can see when there's like, every time there's a QR code being scanned on their phone, it goes to like their SIM and they do the lookup of what did they just scan for a QR code? Did it take anything, take anywhere malicious? Like that kind of level of interaction. Even when they, if they click on a link in an email, like links click from there, they get to sandbox. And if anything pops out that looks weird or there's a jailbreak and all that kind of stuff. So they had some like interesting approaches, even though they were just catering to like the top level within a company. But to your point about what data can you collect? I mean, wouldn't that be great if like that's what you enrolled yourself in if you're going to use your phone in a company? Is yeah, there's going to be software that's going to look for any time you do certain activities to at least put things through a process to help evaluate or automate some of those things. Because like, you know, that you talked about, there were some ways to sidestep some of the sandboxing or the things that evaluate the APK files to determine if they're malicious or not. That still could be true and people can still get around some of the automated stuff. But having that level of visibility alone, because if something happens on someone's cell phone, like what do you do to investigate that? You know, like I don't know what that looks like from like if data is stolen, like how do you find the root cause there? How do you, you know, search that all the way back? I feel like that's hard. Because I frankly haven't done it. But yeah, I think it's just a huge attack service that people should be at least well aware of, because when people aren't paying attention, they make worse decisions, I should say. That's my big highlight. Like I hate the phone space because I see it as just a huge risk. But it's also, yeah, but it's not going anywhere. And we have to accept that no one's ever going to say you can't have a phone. Like you can't, this is not going to happen. So what level of risk are you going to accept? How are you going to manage that risk as the conversation? And then there might be some interesting solutions that come along before that. So, yeah.
Yeah, and it's something that I've never really cracked an egg on in the situations when I was doing, like, you know, security engineer stuff or SOC specific things to look at, like, what data can you collect into a security, you know, net, like in your SIM or something like that. Because that, you know, that helps you kind of manage, at least from a detection and understanding what's happening on the device side. I know there's always the privacy arguments. I tend to be old school and think it's a company device. They're, you know what I mean? Like, it's a company device, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just an interesting thing. And it just seems to be so profound more and more and more. Like, you can't talk to anyone, walk into the world and ask anyone, how many times have you gotten a text message with a link that just said X, you know, the phishing stuff from SMS, yeah. Right?
It's just social,
like, and it's just crazy how often, you know, it's happening. And
a good example of that too is that always aligns with world events. So, like, all the fires are happening in California. Like, I've got a lot of family
names,
and they were sharing, like, fake evacuation notices to get people out of their house so they can actually go in and rob the houses, you know, like, and steal things directly. Yeah. Like all that kind of stuff happening is all happening because they had a cell phone. Like, they wouldn't even be exposed to even that risk if they, you know, weren't tied in that well, you know, that kind of stuff. And then know that those numbers are also associated. I mean, like, this, we can go down the list of risks associated and how people can take advantage of them. I mean, even like, I was going to mention it on the next article, but Kevin Mitnick, like, how did he get his start? He was dealing with how he, you know, telephone freaking to get free calls and then figure out how to, you know, change a lot of the configurations of how telecommunication work, you know.
Yeah, and I've seen personally, like, ways that the cell phones have been leveraged to, you know, hijack tokens in the middle, you know, different apps that have been installed, mostly on Android, but I think it's just because of the way the marketplaces are managed, but mostly on Androids, where you'll get this random app that just gets all this access, right? Like, in particular, as an example, you know, you get this app to do X, Y, or Z thing, and then you unknowingly, because you're not reading through the fine print, no typical user will for an application on a phone, and suddenly you've given it full read-write access with your OAuth creds, and you didn't even know it, and you no idea what it's going to do with that, right? Yeah. But you open this giant door, right?
Oh, yeah.
All right, Scott, what do you got last for us this week?
So last one is something I saw that I just, you know, I always find things like this interesting. And this is the crossover between, you know, cyber and physical, even though physical security nowadays uses technology pretty much as much as any other part of an organization. But I didn't dig into the actual report. I just picked the main story that covered it, which was from Bleeping Computer. And it was titled "Over 49,000 Misconfigured Building Access Systems Exposed Online." And based on this exposure, obviously they're able to there's unencrypted employee data, which included, you know, personal identifiable details, names, addresses, phone numbers, even biometric data when it comes to, like, fingerprints and facial recognition type stuff, photographs. Work schedules potentially can be derived from this, access logs, you know, who entered and exited when. And in some cases, they can actually edit the employee records or add fake employees or access credentials and things like that. So they can manipulate and restrict access depending on what their goals were. And some of these, you know, what's crazy to me too, is when you think of, like, this technology that's supposed to be like, oh, we can validate anytime someone's going to be somewhere. You put this technology in locations you care about most, right? If it was a place you didn't care about, you'd use a padlock and a key and someone would show up when they need to enter whatever it is, right? Like, they would use the old. So you almost introduced a higher level of risk by putting something in place that's supposed to be more secured in an insecure manner. So, you know, it was just crazy find. I'm not surprised because I feel like these types of systems are those ones that it's like, hey, we got this building, we need to secure, we need to get this up, we need to get this working, right? Not thinking, and a lot of the people that may even be managing some of these systems don't even think about how these things work as far as how they can be exposed even publicly, like they are. So these should be on, like, I would sometimes even consider their own network, to be isolated, only talk to where they need to go. If you need to have site-to-site stuff, you're writing things over VPN tunnels and stuff that you set up. And yeah, in this case, there's just a lot that aren't. And then, like I said, I mentioned Kevin Mitnick earlier. Like, one of the few ways he was able to gain some access when he got really into like telecommunication stuff, and he needed to have like certain materials. Like he even wanted to get his hands on manuals, because back then, if you wanted to figure out something worked, if you get your hands on the manual, all of a sudden you kind of had everything you needed. He would break into these places, these telecommunication companies, to look for that kind of stuff. So, you know, people come back to like, well, what's the risk, right? You know, obviously you have people that can gain access or learn about it, but like, there's a lot of information there that someone can steal, right? And use for social engineering, for instance. Or if you have that kind of information, you can figure out how to blend in better if you already have access based on certain people. I thought that one of the most interesting things, and I always find this interesting, is, you know, we talked about passwords earlier. You know, passwords are at least something you could change, right? So if you have this inkling or you need to roll it, like we talked about the API keys, you know, roll them every so often, and then that doesn't really matter. Biometric data of who you are with your fingerprints and your face, like that's not something you could just change, right? So I assume there's ways to how you scan it. Maybe you can like store it in a way that, you know, that's like salted or fingerprinted by that scanner. So, you know, I don't know. But that was always my original take on why biometric data is always the best to go for, because at least if I lose my password, I can change it. If I lose my fingerprint, I just got to figure out how to deal with it, right? But if that data is leaving, then how else can that be leveraged, you know, down the road, for things? And obviously changing access, I mean, that's a big, I mean, even if like, and this is also where it gets scary for me, is if you have the interest of a nation state, especially if you're, it's like a war perspective, right? And you're able to say, hey, we're going to create impact at this location, and it's an location where maybe you have access to SCADA type things. And you know that ultimately all someone has to do is throw a switch to disable the access, and then you lose access and you're not going to disrupt what you think it'll disrupt. Imagine if you can get into a system that then prevents anyone from having access to even get past their own security controls to get in to shut down whatever it is that you caused, right? That's like a major combined sophisticated attack, because you left yourself open to that. So like, or ransomware people, really, you know, they can obviously get information possibly to sell from these things. They can get maybe potentially access. But it's like a different way of thinking. Like, what is the ultimate risk? Well, it depends on what the motive is, right? If the motive is bad, this is a really bad one. Luckily, there's a lot of people that don't have that level of motive as far as what kind of destruction, damage, whatever they want to cause. So it becomes more of a, you know, shame on you type of conversation. But I think it's good they highlighted it. And these types of fines, I think we find these all the time. If you look at any technology that people think is rudimentary, like, oh, I mean, it's just this, it does very simple, it doesn't interact or talk to things. Cool. Who can reach it? That's usually the first question. So yeah. What are your thoughts?
A whole lot. I mean, this one touches on a bunch of things, man. You know, in my experience, there is this conversation, and we talk about so many things so often, especially like in the security field, right? Just in our realm. And I'm sure this happens in other areas too, but where we hear words almost become buzzwords or just referenced in a way that they shouldn't be. So this is full opinion here, but I'm just going to backtrack to something you had said. So when I hear people talk about risk and they say, well, you know, what's the risk? Blah, 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 blah. It's there. If you don't know, like my first thought as a security professional is this thing that you're putting on our network, or is this thing that we're putting in place to do X, Y, or Z thing? I just want to ask the question, does it open any door for somebody to leverage? And then start the conversation with effective risk discussion from that point. I've run into this buzzsaw personally a few times where it's like, hey, I'm pointing at that door that's open and there's already been this assessment of risk, but they haven't talked about the fact that that door is open. Do you get what I'm saying? So like,
yeah, they do the risk as if all everything worked.
Yeah. If it works, yeah. Or yeah, if it doesn't, if you can't, like we put access control on this thing or whatever, there's certain like check boxes that occur, right?
Yeah.
But, and to me, like the physical security stuff, this one's interesting because I personally think like, this is like a really fun space that I think there
that can leverage that teamwork thing we were talking about a little while ago, where like multiple different focuses can come together, especially from like a red team perspective. Like, let somebody go at your stuff and see if they can get anything from it, right? You might not, it might not cripple your business. They might just get data access. But on the other side of that, you might find really simple things that were overlooked in a process, right? So let's say you had, you know, card readers, right? So you're not, maybe it's old school. Maybe you're not using biometrics. Maybe you're using some kind of a card reader. And the system that they have in place, they're using these cards, have basic, you know, might have basic RFID chips in them that are, that they're levers, they're assigned to a person. People might be wearing them on a lanyard, have them in their pocket, whatever it might be. And they use these to get into different places. And with that, they didn't consider, is that RFID chip encrypted? Because if not, all it would take is a simple RFID scanner and cloner to be within a vicinity, and you can suddenly clone that badge real quickly. And then you could just walk around and use that badge, right? So it, you don't have a basic conversations like that. So what I'm getting at is like, I really would love to see these realms communicate more, because they would benefit each other so much. Like, it doesn't need to be some crazy overhead, right?
Well,
just ask the question, does it open a door? And if it does, then expand on the conversation, right?
Well, I think it's interesting because a lot of, like you said, checkbox, and maybe go back to like evaluating the risk here. So, you know, a lot of people are like, okay, so someone gets access and then what, right? They assume like their focus is solely on that door, and if they get through that door, sure. But if compliance, if you had to then report, hey, an unauthorized access entered, say, a nuclear power plant, compliance would go nuts, and there could be like fees and fines, especially if they find out that you didn't even set up the system properly, right? That'd be a really big hit to the company.
Yeah.
And so the risk is actually really high depending on what that door, what that system's protecting. But I think a lot of people don't think of the inverse of that. Like, what if it's a nuclear power plant that the right people can't get access to, right? Like, that's almost worse in some aspects, because if there is a serious thing happening and you can't get the people in there to address the issue, now that issue might impact more than just the company at that point, right? So, like, I have always liked the drill of risk assessments, because it forces you to like, well, we got to think about all the type of risks. But what I hate is not a single person could come up with every possible scenario, and you're playing, it's all hypotheticals that you're playing with. So to really like tie that down, it's kind of a exercise that's futile in a sense, right? Like, it's best effort. Can I think of things, and can I address the things that I myself can think of? Like, I don't know. It's always been like a tough one for me to swallow. And that's why I kind of like compliance, because there's like these are the things we require, and these are the things why. So it becomes checkbox, because it makes risk assessments easier. And then they could be like, then you're at least not forgetting a big area. But then some people stop there. So it's got to be definitely a blend between the two. But yeah, I mean, it's hard. I mean, that's why I feel like when people like make things overly secure, it's like, well, yeah, it's because they know they can't think of every possible scenario. And if they do that, they'll still might miss something, but at least they know they made the best effort versus doing the bare minimum. But I don't know. It's a tough space to be in.
There's a, you know, there's something, if I could stitch this a little bit, just to, you know, anyone who might be listening that, you know, is trying to get into threat hunting or thinking about new ideas for expanding, you know, their ROI or their deliveries, what they can, you know, kind of contribute. These areas are really fun to go blind in and see what's what. I've had a lot of fun in the past, and we've talked about stuff like the ICS side, like those kinds of things in past shows. Physical security stuff, that the technology in this area is very much overlooked most of the time from a cyber standpoint. But by and large, these things are very, very much cyber devices in a lot of ways. They're connected to your network. They're requiring different communication vectors. They have access to access data, to personal data, all kinds of things, right? If you have never thought about
it, interact with the world, right? Like,
yeah. And if you're in a place where these things exist, and maybe your company's never really thought about taking a look, and you want a, you know, pet project to go see what you could potentially value add there, I highly recommend going and taking a look into these systems and the data that they do provide or could provide that you could enhance, right?
Yeah.
And I bet any amount of money, anybody that takes that advice and goes and looks, you'll find some interesting things, because I know I have in the past.
No, I agree. It's always best to look in areas where most people aren't looking. That's when you always are guaranteed to find at least something, right?
Yeah, just a little bit of curiosity will take you down a wild rabbit hole in cybersecurity for sure.
All right. Well, cool. This has been kind of a fun conversation. But before we drop off here, I want to make sure to mention some of the really cool things that are also up and coming. We've got the top cover, the fourth one that's happening March 5th, which is this Wednesday. It's going to be at 12 p.m. I'll be talking on what would make an effective, you know, threat hunter and threat hunting team as far as hiring effective threat hunters and making them work tactically within your environment. And then we also have our Out of the Woods live podcast happening March 13th from 12 p.m. to 1:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That's just like our past live ones, but basically you can interact with us live through Discord, have some good conversations, usually have people interject and add their thoughts, which is great. And then we also have Threat Hunting Foundations workshop titled Beyond IOCs to Behaviors and TTPs. So that's going to be really good. It actually is a full kind of fledged workshop March 27th, and that's from 9:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So it's really going to be digging in to really, if you've never threat hunted before or been thinking about what is threat hunting, it's a great place to kind of get the full experience or full exposure to that. So definitely check that out. So with that, I really want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. And with that, that closes out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of March 3rd, 2025. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everybody.